The highest military honor bestowed by the United States of America is the Medal of Honor. It's awarded to those who have shown the most exceptional of heroism on behalf of country and comrades. But go back 3 millennia to ancient Israel, and the highest military honor that was bestowed upon those who were in the country of Israel and in King David's army was to be listed among the mighty men, the 30 mighty men. The list begins in 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 24. Among the 30 were Asahel, the brother of Joab, Elhanan, the son of Dodo from Bethlehem. And then the list ends in verse 39, saying there were 37 in all. Okay, it's the 30 mighty men, and there are 37 names in the list, which makes you wonder if this particular historian was, a little unable to count. And I don't know, I'm kind of critical of getting the numbers messed up. And then I remember that the University of Minnesota Gophers belong to the Big Ten, of which there are 11 universities. And we're going to add the University of Nebraska, so there's going to be 12 in the Big Ten, which I have concluded is that the Big Ten does not set its name by the math department. It's another department at the University of Minnesota that decides what it's called. And the point here is that the Big Ten is more of a brand than a count, and that the 30 mighty men of Israel was sort of a brand, a list of those who were the greatest heroes in Israel. And it was a group that changed. So one would die and another would be added, and 37 are here listed. Israel's Hall of Heroes opens with a shorter list of superheroes, the 3. It's a little bit unclear whether these 3 are in addition to the 30 or part of the 30, but either way, it's a very special list. And first to be named is Joshua. These are the names of David's mighty men. Joshua, Bashabeth, a Tehkamanite, was chief of the 3. He raised his spear against 800 men whom he killed in one encounter. So Joshua, we'd probably call him Josh today. If he were in the United States military now, if he were in the Air Force and a fighter pilot, we would call him an ace pilot. There would be decals next to the cockpit outside the airplane showing how many planes he had shot down. Josh had killed 800 of the enemy soldiers in one battle. Maybe he did it alone. I suppose in all probability he had others who helped him. But however it happened, he became a military legend. There are some people who rise to prominence through incremental steps. But then there are some who on one day say or do something spectacular. And that one day defines all of life. It's hard to imagine that Joshua got up that day and anticipated what he would actually do, or that as a result of that, he would become one of the military legends for all of history. And we face battles like that, sometimes unexpectedly, frighteningly. You're thrown into a battle that you never could have anticipated when you went to bed the night before or got up that morning. It may be a family crisis that feels like a war, or it may be a medical emergency that just puts you under awful stress, a great attack, or a business battle of some kind of epic proportions. And you realize this is the day. It's like all of life up until now has been a preparation, and all of life after this day will be remembered in terms of how you are defined on that one day. And like Joshua, that is the day when you may raise your spear and act heroically and be listed forever after as a hero. Next to him was Eleazar, the son of Dodai the Ahohite. As one of the three mighty men, he was with David when they taunted the Philistines gathered at Pasdamim for battle. Then the men of Israel retreated, but he stood his ground and struck down the Philistines till his hand grew tired and froze to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day. The troops returned to Eleazar, but only to strip the dead. Eleazar was trapped in what would be a soldier's worst nightmare. The battle began well enough. He was on the front line because he was thought to be good, side by side with David himself, who was renowned as the best fighter in all the army of Israel. And they were up against their ongoing enemies, the Philistines, and they taunted them. You know, you taunt an enemy when you are very confident, when you're sure that you are smarter, stronger, better. It's sort of, come on, bring it on, bring it on. Just, you know, let's take this fight and let's just do it and get it over with. And maybe you've been there, where you've been on a winning streak, where your company has the best products, where you've faced that disease before and you beat it and come out just fine. You've conquered the enemy. So bring it on another time. But this battle wasn't as easy as it looked. The enemy was stronger than anticipated. They fought with greater courage than would have been predicted. And the battle didn't go well. And suddenly, every soldier in the army of Israel is retreating. They're running away. It's humiliating. It's just awful, except for Eleazar. He stands and he fights alone. Everybody else leaves, but he continues to fight, even if it cost him his life. And he won. He won. He fought the battle alone and won the battle. And then, after it's all over, his comrades who retreated, they come back again, only to share in the spoils of victory. So hooray for Eleazar. He belongs here in this hall of heroes. And so do you. When you do what is right, when other people do what is wrong, when you stand firm and strong, when others run away in fear, hooray for you. When you maintain your faith at the very moment when it seems like everyone else around you is caving in, cheers for you. If you hold on to morality when everything in our culture is calling for immorality, when you are kind to other people, when everybody else is being vicious, when you speak in love, when everybody else is speaking words of hate, hooray for you. You're like Eleazar. And is that hard to do? Is it hard when everybody else retreats to stand and to fight alone? You know, it can seemingly be impossibly hard, enormously dangerous. But take heart, because there's an amazing line here that says that while to every appearance Eleazar was alone in this battle when everyone else retreated, God was there. That God was there in the battle and by his side, and the Lord brought about a great victory that day. When we stand alone, especially when up against a formidable enemy and others have retreated, there is a sore temptation to think that we are totally alone. That is, that no one else has ever faced what we are facing. Nobody else has ever been through this before. We are completely unique. But actually, God has more heroes than we might guess. Because next to Eleazar was Shammah, the son of Agee, the Hararite. When the Philistines banded together at a place where there was a field full of lentils, Israel's troops fled from them. But Shammah took his stand in the middle of the field. He defended it and struck the Philistines down, and the Lord brought about a great victory. So he was kind of like Eleazar. He took his stand when others left. He was willing to fight to the death for a field of lentils? I mean, is that really a good decision to make? Is it worth dying for some vegetation on somebody's farm? Because one of the most important decisions of life is which battle to fight. It's not just winning the battle or even fighting the battle. It's making sure that battles are chosen wisely. So is it a wise thing to put your life at risk for a field of lentils? There are some people who will fight for anything. They don't have any trouble choosing battles. They fight them all, no matter what. And if it's not a battle, they can make it into a battle. And it reminds me of a conversation I was in where they're talking about a woman who's a radio personality, and she fights everybody every time that she is in front of a microphone. And there was somebody in this circle of conversation who said, oh, I was with her in third grade and she did the same thing then. So she's somebody who just likes to fight for fighting's sake, but not really for principle's sake. Sharma must have known that this field of lentils was strategically important. So he made his decision carefully, because sometimes it's the out-of-the-way and inconspicuous places where battles are fought that determine the outcome of an entire war. And he picked this battle carefully. Perhaps you've seen the very long film Gettysburg. There is a part of it that focuses on Joshua Chamberlain, a graduate of Bangor Seminary and a professor at Bowdoin College in Maine, who volunteered for the militia in the Civil War and was assigned to the 20th Maine. Many of those soldiers were killed in the skirmishes and battles that followed. And he was assigned to him a group of deserters that he really didn't know if he could count on or not. They were on their way to a place that he had probably never heard of before. It was rich farmland at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And his unit was told that they were to hold a hill called Little Round Top. It probably didn't seem very important or significant at the time. What was unanticipated is that a major force of the Confederate Army attacked the Little Round Top. Until the 20th Maine was just about completely out of ammunition. It was then that Colonel Chamberlain issued a legendary military order. Against all odds, under attack, outnumbered, outgunned, clear defeat in their face, Colonel Chamberlain said to his men, "Fix your bayonets and charge." And without ammunition, they charged the enemy forces and not only stopped them, but turned them around. And it became an important element in a decisive battle that determined the outcome of the war. The hill was held. They were heroes. Now, if you visit that hill, the Little Round Top today, it is a quiet and tranquil place. It doesn't seem like a bloody battle was fought there. Or go back to Israel to where there was this field of lentils, and you would say, it doesn't seem like that was the spot for the great battle. But we have those choices ourselves. That sooner or later, we are called to fight a battle in an inconsequential place that has a significance that is far greater. And when that happens, don't quit. Don't retreat. Take your stand in the middle of the field. And may God do for you what he did for Shama. The Lord brought about a great victory. In this list of the great heroes, not all are remembered by name. There were three unnamed heroes who loved their leader enough to risk their lives. During harvest time, three of the 30 chief men came down to David at the cave of Adullam while a band of Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim. At that time, David was in the stronghold and the Philistine garrison was at Bethlehem. David longed for water and said, that someone would get me a drink of water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem. So the three mighty men broke through the Philistine lines, drew water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem, and carried it back to David. But he refused to drink it. Instead, he poured it out before the Lord. "Far be it from me, O Lord, to do this," David said. "Is it not the blood of men who went at the risk of their lives?" And David just wouldn't drink it. Such were the exploits of the three mighty men. That was back in the days before David was king, when they were against their continuous enemies, the neighboring nation of Philistia. It was guerrilla warfare. David was holed up in a cave at a place called Adullam. And most sadly, the Philistines had taken over his hometown. They'd actually set up a garrison there. In all probability, his homestead and his own family were behind enemy lines. And things were bleak. I sort of picture David sitting around the campfire, and he speaks a whim, not an order. He's homesick, and he sort of is talking out loud, and he says, "Ah, I wish I could have a drink from the well at Bethlehem. That was the water I drank as a boy. How good that would be." And then without telling him, three of his soldiers sneaked out of the camp and through enemy lines at enormous personal risk. They easily could have been caught and killed. And they drew water out of the well and they brought it back to David. And at that moment, David knew that he could totally trust these soldiers no matter what would ever happen. We may say that they took an excessive risk. David said they were absolutely heroic. David, he was shocked and grateful. And he did something that may seem strange, if not offensive, to some of us. He wouldn't drink the water that they had gotten at risk of their own lives. They had done this out of love and loyalty to him. And David, when he poured it out, was actually offering it up as a sacrifice to God. For by that he was saying, as they love me and are loyal to me, so I will generously give as has been generously given to me. And he offers it as a sacrifice to God. In Australia, they have a common expression referred to as the tall poppy syndrome. That if you look out across a field of poppies, sometimes you'll see one that sticks up above all the rest. And there are those who want to go and cut it off so that all are at the same height. And so the tall poppy syndrome says that in the culture, if anyone succeeds above everyone else, that person needs to be taken down, needs to be humbled, needs to be cut off. But that was never the attitude of these unnamed mighty men of David. They wanted their leader to succeed. They were willing to put their lives on the line so that he could become a winner. And I want to be like that. I want to be the kind of person that doesn't chop other people down, but helps them to succeed, helps them to be winners. David was so grateful to have those who would contribute to his success. And so let us count here among the mighty, those of us who are willing to take risks in order to make our leaders into winners. Abishai, next on the list, was as brave as the others, although somehow he didn't quite share the same title. Abishai, the brother of Joab, son of Zeruiah, was chief of the three. He raised his spear against 300 men whom he killed, and so he became as famous as the three. Was he not held in greater honor than the three? He became their commander, even though he was not included among them. I'm not sure I fully understand exactly what they're saying here, except to note that he was a full-fledged hero by any comparison and by any standard. He was just as brave as Joshua and Shammah and Eleazar. He stood his ground against 300 at once, single-handedly took them down. No, he never held the rank that his brother held, who was general of the army, General Joab. But he was famous and respected, even though he missed out on the top honors. I know a lot of people who are like Abishai. They are those who are courageous to be right, to do what is good, and to win the battle for God, even though they never hold a position. And you know, most of the Abishais that I know don't really care whether they hold a position and get the accolades or not. These are those who are mighty for God, who do what is right, and we thank God for them, even if they never hold some position of prominence. And then there was Ben. Benaiah was his full name, who made this list in the most unusual acts of heroism. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant fighter from Kabzeel who performed great exploits. He struck down two of Moab's best men. He also went down into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. And he struck down a huge Egyptian. Although the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, Benaiah went against him with a club. He snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. Such were the exploits of Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada. He too was famous as the three mighty men. He was held in greater honor than any of the 30, but he was not included among the three. And David put him in charge of his bodyguard. Benaiah was the kind of person who is just quick to fight any necessary enemy, no matter how formidable. So even if it's two against one, two of the best soldiers of the neighbor enemy nation of Moab, he would take them on and fight them. Even if it was a giant from Egypt who had a long spear and he couldn't reach a sword or a spear of his own, all he could get his hand on was a club. He didn't let that bother him. He just went after this giant Egyptian and fought him until he took the spear away from him and used the weapon against him. So he was really courageous and really good, but going into a pit after a lion? I don't know what your experiences are with lions, but I don't think that's a good idea. I can't imagine doing that. Recently, I met a woman who got her PhD in the study of lions at the University of Minnesota. I said, "Are you from Minnesota?" She said, "No, she was from New England." And she came to Minnesota and spent 7 years here studying lions. I mean, I didn't even know the University of Minnesota had a thing with lionology, but apparently we do. And she told me a story about a major surgery that was done on a lion. So I don't know how you picture this, but here's an operating room with a full-grown lion on the operating table. And they did the surgery, and it was successful. And the lion had a bad reaction to the anesthesia. And she said that when the lion was waking up, it was just crazy, and attacked his own paw. So he's biting down and starting to rip through the flesh on his own paw. So she reached to grab something to put in his mouth. Now, I have no idea why this would be in an operating room, but that's what she said. She found a bone from some animal that she said was about 4 or 5 inches in diameter. And she grabbed the bone and shoved it into the lion's mouth so it would stop chewing on its own paw. And she said the lion bit down and crushed that bone. So I'm thinking you don't want to chase a lion into a pit, especially on a snowy day, because pits are, you know, you can get into a pit, but getting out of a pit is harder. And on a snowy day, when the sides of the pit are slippery and the lion has good traction and you don't, it just, on the face of it, doesn't seem like a good idea. But Benaiah, you know, he was the kind of hero who chased after the most challenging of opportunities. And you wonder, why would a story like this be included? Because it showed the kind of hero that Benaiah was. He wasn't stopped by difficult situations. You know the kind of things that we gripe and complain about and wish weren't part of our lives? He would run into them and seize them. And God would give him the victory in situations that none of us would ever want or would ever choose. And David saw in him the kind of person that he wanted to be part of his bodyguard, actually the chief of his bodyguard and part of the royal court. It was because he rose to the crisis and entered the situation as an opportunity rather than as something bad that he was promoted to the royal court. We all face our Egyptians that are giants with spears. We sometimes have to chase down lions that would attack the herd and chase them into a pit. These are the lousy situations in life you never want. These are the kind of things that you complain about and say, why would God even allow this in my life? This is the bad boss, or being married to an unloving husband or wife, or it's dealing with a prodigal son or daughter, or bullying at school, or dangerous drivers on the interstate. It's what you don't want. But Benaiah was the kind of person who dealt with the scary stuff. So what do you do with the stuff in life that's hard and dangerous and you don't like? Run away? Blame God? Give up? Or be like Benaiah, who jumped into the pit to turn a bad situation into good, to grab the spear and turn a threat into victory? Because the way we handle lions and Egyptian giants, that's what prepares us for the promotions of God into the royal court of the king. You can read the rest of the names of the mighty men for yourself. We don't know much about them. Their names are hard to pronounce. They were famous in their generation. They were honored by king and country. And they were included by God in the Bible. But there is one name on this long ago list that we do remember. The list ends with Zelek the Ammonite, Naharai the Barathite, the armor bearer of Joab, the son of Zariah, Ira the Ithrite, Gareb the Ithrite, and Uriah the Hittite. No details about him, because whole chapters have already been given to his story. He was a great man. He was brave and loyal and courageous. He was the best of the best. He was among the 30 mighty men of King David's army. And the man to whom he was loyal and for whom he was willing to risk his life, while he was gone, seduced his wife, Bathsheba, impregnated her, tried to trick him, but he could never be tricked into doing that which was wrong. This brave and courageous man had his own leader put out an order of execution, and he died needlessly and tragically in battle. But his name's to be remembered. His name is the last one. It is the capstone on the list of the mighty man. He is to be remembered most of all for the good and the courage and the heroism that he did, and not for the evil that was done against him, so that for all of history he would be remembered, and for all of eternity at the end of the list. And Uriah the Hittite. So even if our trust is betrayed, even when others sin against us, even when our leaders fail, we are called upon to be strong and courageous and loyal and true, to claim the victory that God gives to us, to be on the list like Uriah the Hittite. God, count us among those who are mighty for you, who are undaunted up against situations that we would hate to fight, but now are in. Give to us strength and courage and wisdom and victory. In Jesus' name, amen.